Hello, and welcome to the Business Decisions Podcast. My name is Stuart Wood, and I'm the CEO of Caravel Law. Every week, we bring you stories and insights from founders, owners, and leaders of great businesses, followed by some thoughts and input from one of Caravel's lawyers. Caravel Law has been a leader in legal innovation in Canada since 2004 and has helped many startups and small businesses overcome challenges as they have scaled and succeeded. Our hope is that these discussions will help existing business leaders and inspire others to start their own ventures. Now, let's get to today's guest. Today on the podcast, I'm going to be talking to Anurag Banerjee of Quilt.ai. Anurag is the co-founder and CEO of Quilt.ai based in Singapore. Quilt.ai is trying to do some pretty incredible stuff with data, collecting lots of information to see if they can increase the amount of empathy in the world and see if they can derive some insights that can be used to address some of the biggest challenges that societies are facing around the world. It's a fascinating company. I think you'll really enjoy that conversation. Following my conversation with Anurag, I'm joined by Kim Von Arks, a lawyer with Caravel Law. We're going to be talking about some of the challenges that companies face when they are collecting a massive amount of data, and in particular, how a company can make the public comfortable that they are both using and storing that data carefully. We'll also talk briefly about GDPR and how that affects companies in Canada and elsewhere and some of the obligations that companies now have to be aware of. I do want to mention that there were some sound quality challenges during my conversation with Anurag of Quilt.ai, but I hope it's not too much of a distraction because it's a fascinating company and I think Anurag shares some really important insights for other entrepreneurs. So with that, here's my conversation with Anurag Banerjee of Quilt.ai. Okay, I'm delighted to have Anurag Banerjee on the podcast today. Anurag is the co-founder and CEO of Quilt.ai and is joining us on the podcast from Singapore. His company has got offices in Singapore, New York, and London, about 45 people in total on the team. Anurag has a BA in economics, a master's in organizational development, and also studied at Harvard Business School. He had a long career in business development for American Express and has worked as part of several prominent startups, including Jana and Social Cops. And for the last 2 years, Anurag has been building this company and his team at Quilt.ai, which is a fascinating company. And I'm looking forward to speaking with him about it today. Anurag, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Stuart. Glad to be here. Thank you for the time.
So tell us a little bit about Quilt.ai.
Gosh. So Quilt.ai is more than a decade in the making in some shape or form. In the depth of the financial crisis, I was struck with, you know, understanding why people weren't paying credit card bills. And there was no way to actually understand humanity at a fairly large enough scale and behavior patterns. And a lot of the customer research or consumer research that exists even today is tied to small and inaccurate sample sizes. So people talk to 10, 15, 50 people or survey 100 people and make predictions about the population. And as we've seen with some of the political choices, it becomes inaccurate because samples don't end up representing the population. So with Quilt.ai, the intent is twofold. One is, can we study large enough groups of people in an anonymized, aggregated way to help organizations, both for-profit and non-profit, make better decisions? That's the fundamental premise of what we're trying to build here.
When you're looking at the examples, do you mean the polling samples that then have led to surprises on election day?
Yes, not just that. I think so that's definitely been what's been the most newsworthy. But consistently in our conversations with chief marketing officers, as well as with folks who run large foundations and non-profits, the information that they've gathered from small groups of people has let them down in terms of the service they've built or the product they've built to service large populations. For example, Stuart, you know, if someone talks to you and me and we're the same age, same socioeconomic, same demographic, two kids, etc., but we don't behave the same, so it's hard to extrapolate by talking to you about what 40-year-old men should be doing, thinking, buying, working on.
Okay, so it's with regards to what people believe are well-researched hypotheses that then don't produce the predicted outcome. One of the potential causes is the small sample size that was used as part of the research for that hypothesis. Is that right?
That's exactly right, yes.
So how is Quilt as a solution better than those traditional surveys?
Quilt.ai looks at every single digital exhaust that's left behind. And when we think of digital exhaust, we often mistake it just for, you know, what you or I might say on Instagram or even Twitter. But there are four kinds of digital exhausts. One is what we call stated, which is what everybody else calls social media. And that's a sliver of our digital existence. Then there's all the stuff that we discuss on forums, on blogs, on threads. That's discussion data. Then there's consumption data, which is, you know, what videos did I see? What movies did I watch? What do I think of that? And all those are parts of me. And the fourth is, what did I search for? What am I curious about? What do I want to learn? What are my fears, my apprehensions, my interests? And when you combine all of these in some shape or form, you end up with a better interpretation than speaking to somebody or asking somebody in a survey if they liked X product or Y service. So the idea is to get as much information about as many people as possible, so a brand or a nonprofit can take a better decision.
And the .ai in your company name, I assume, is how you're managing such a massive data set.
Yes. I mean, some of it is fancy, because .ai is a cool cool thing to do. But jokes aside, we've been building some basic and some relatively decent tools to manage this large set of data, to be able to do math on it, to extract meaning out of terabytes of. We just had something this morning where we looked at 30 million reviews about a particular face wash. Now, to do that physically would have been impossible. So the compute power and the interpretation layer is where the .ai comes from.
So you're saying there were 13 million data points regarding that face wash somewhere in the digital world?
30.
There were 30 million data points, either relating to someone watching content or commenting on it or interacting in some way with that brand.
Exactly. Or searching for it, or finding out more about it in some forum. But yes, all of those aggregated. And I don't think we have all of it as yet either.
And so is the brand team your customer that has hired you to collect all that information and provide them with some insights from it?
Yes. So our typical customer is either a CMO or a brand manager or often an insights manager. We're looking for both a quick check-in on how their brand is. I mean, they have basically three questions, every brand in some shape or form. Question number one is, who is my customer? What does Stuart want from me? What does he think about me? Will he buy more of my product? That's question one. Second one is the category question. Where else is Stuart shopping? What else is out there? Who are my competitors? What are they saying? What do people like or dislike about them versus me? And the third is, where is my space headed? For example, will face wash become redundant? Or will mobile phones become redundant as you move to wearables? So where is the macro space headed, and what trends are breaking out that people are adopting that might impact my brand? But those are the typical questions that the brand team has for us.
And how much of those answers can come directly from the data versus requiring someone on your team to interpret that data?
So the data, and Stuart, you know, this data is only as powerful as the way you interpret it. Now, we've built, the joke that I have about our AI engine is my five-year-old is smarter than my AI engine, because, for example, if he touches a hot kettle, he's never going to touch it again for the rest of his life. But to train the AI engine not to touch a hot kettle after having touched it once, you've got to make the engine, you're going to train the engine multiple times, thousands of times often. So the data gives us a lot of insights. We train models to create meaning out of the data, but there is definitely a human in the loop to either validate, augment, adjust or correct. And the models get better significantly once an adjustment happens, and the human intervention reduces dramatically over a period of time.
And how do you correct for the fact that the population that's on Twitter, for example, isn't necessarily representative of the overall population?
Awesome question. Thank you. I almost feel like you set me up there well. So I think the premise that we're trying to solve is brand A wants to get insights into its customers, and they would do it historically with a 10-person focus group or 200-person survey. Now, there's probably, you know, for the same brand, there's probably 10x or 15x that number on Twitter. And Twitter is one sliver of data. And while they have an amazing API, it's still one sliver of the data. So we're not looking just at Twitter. So we have about 6.5 million different sources of data that we pull daily. And the idea is you will never have complete population in any sliver, but in an aggregate format, you'll have enough meaningful context that comes up.
Are you collecting that data every day, or are you collecting what you need whenever a new project begins?
We started with the latter, where we would collect as per project need. But as we evolved into more of an always-on product, we are collecting data on a daily basis. We have some large challenges around storage that we still are trying to figure out, but that's the model.
Yeah, I can imagine that database gets huge pretty quickly.
Yes, we're basically replicating the internet, right?
Yeah, exactly. The AWS bill gets pretty large. What kind of projects has your company done so far?
We've done roughly about, I think by the end of this year, we would have done just over 300 projects in the last 24 months. And they range from helping a brand understand what messaging it should use on its back to understanding where it should focus on which customers in which catchment area, to understanding what cultural nuances are changing as a global trend becomes a local trend in, say, fashion. And that's on the for-profit side, which is 50% of our time and effort. And the rest, the balance of the 50% is broken up into both paid and unpaid work. So we have 25% of our paid time going into working with large foundations, bilaterals, multilaterals, and where we help them essentially understand things around mental health. What does it take for someone to go from being depressed to suicidal and to day zero? What does it take for boys to wear condoms? What does it take for parents to vaccinate their children? So those are the use cases that we work on, Stuart.
So a couple of those examples prompted a number of questions. So for example, on the vaccination question, you would see very heated arguments on both sides of that if you spend time on social media. How do you isolate the arguments that will be persuasive to parents to get them to vaccinate their children?
Great question. So vaccination, there's been this controversy for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, a lot of the anti-vaccine reports were debunked. And now it's scientifically clear that vaccines do not cause any harm. However, there is this naturalistic, organic tendency in a fairly high socioeconomic classes across the world, which leads to them not vaccinating their children. And the arguments they make are less scientific, but more from a point of view of it essentially being a kind of revolution of taking control of their lives and their children's lives. And the way to optimize on that argument is to seep messages into people's ecosystems that align with trying to break the filter bubble. And then I always use the example of saying Mark Twain said travel broadens your mind, and broadens your mind because you go and experience a new culture, a new point of view. Our filter bubbles, our news feeds, our filter bubbles. So we are used to getting a certain reinforced algorithm that keeps giving us the same kind of messaging. So, but if that filter bubble is pricked, and a combination of rationality and emotion is used to prick that filter bubble and say, actually, climate change is a real thing. You should consider these options, or actually, there is no evidence that vaccines cause damage. And some people you will never sway some people, but you will sway the middle ground.
And it sounds like your solution will also just help understand what are the obstacles to persuading the ones that are persuadable.
Yes.
And so does Quilt AI collect that data and then report it to people who will take action on it? Or do you actually support, you know, the initiatives to try to insert new thoughts or arguments into the discussion?
No, we're not domain experts. So we focus on helping a foundation or a nonprofit understand where the conversations are, what it'll take to convince an Anurag to vaccinate his child. Think of us as somebody who helps an organization with optimizing messaging on top of the research and the insights that we deliver. Because a lot of the information that's given out by some of these organizations is fairly sterile, it's fairly scientific. And for example, while I know that, say, a Diet Coke is bad for me, with no offense to Coca-Cola, I still drink it because of an emotional trigger that it has. So the messaging that you can't tell me not to drink Diet Coke because it's unhealthy, I already know that. There should be some other lever you pull to get me to stop drinking it. And those are the levers that we advise our organizations to use.
And so when you talk about something like that and sort of taking action on behalf of a brand to try to change my behavior, that's the sort of stuff that gets people a little bit nervous about these sorts of companies. So there's a lot of data that's out there about all of us. And I think we're all aware at some level that we're being tracked and monitored at all times, especially in our online behavior. How do you get people comfortable with what Quilted AI is doing?
Good question. We never, ever work on a brand. So I would never persuade a Pepsi drinker to drink Coca-Cola or an iPhone user to become a Samsung user. We don't do that. What we do for brands is just give insights on what makes a good iPhone customer. And that's essentially giving scale to consumer research they would do anyway. But for causes that are important, which are teenage pregnancies, which are anti-vaccination, which are diabetes, which are smoking cessation, in those cases, we take a fairly simple moral stand and say that actually there's enough evidence that smoking kills. And so if you can give guidance to organizations that are fighting smoking habits, here is the kind of guidance from behavioral science perspective that you would give them. So it's a moral framework. There is no, and we're using insights that advertisers have used for decades to talk to people in tones that are more appealing to them. We're just using it for good.
And so the data is always in large sets, so it's never personalized to individuals?
Never. It's aggregated, it's anonymized, it's fully GDPR compliant. And fundamentally, Stuart, I'm not interested, with no offense to anybody, in an individual. I care about understanding behavior at scale, but with enough specificity so it's actionable. But the steward or the Anurag doesn't interest me. What interests me is what does a cohort believe, view, think, act on.
When you're describing something like how do we address an issue like teenage pregnancy, would your client essentially be a government, or is it sort of a not-for-profit that is looking to take those lessons and apply them on a global scale? Who's retaining you to work on something like that?
It's a not-for-profit. So we've stayed clearly away from political parties. We will not work for the left or the right. And we've not done any work for any government either. So it is almost always non-profit entities, large organizations, whether it's different foundations or the UN group, that set of organizations has used.
Do you have a set of guiding principles that you've had in place since the beginning to govern how your company makes those decisions?
We do. And I've told the story of once earlier, so or a couple of times at least, and I'll say it again. When we started the company, my co-founder, who's an anthropologist and a PhD, home for dinner, and my seven-year-old daughter at that point in time, said, "Well, Daddy, new startup. What's the plan?" And I was struggling to explain the plan.
It's always a good test if you can explain it to your child, right?
True, isn't it? And so Angad says to Anika, my daughter, says, "Who's your best friend?" And Anika, like every precocious 7-year-old kid, says, "Sienna." who's one of our neighbors. And Angad asks her, well, why is Sienna your best friend? And he said, well, you know, because I know everything about her. And Angad says, well, that's what Daddy and I try to do. We're trying to make friends of everybody. And we won't, I don't think that's what we'll succeed at or even end up at, but I think there's a clear lack of civil discourse on topics and a clear lack of empathy in the world. So our guiding principle is a very simple one. We may disagree on multiple things, but we should be empathetic enough to understand the other's point of view. And some of these topics can be very challenging and controversial, like abortion or guns or vaccines, or even how we vote, or you know how we raise our children. But an understanding for the other is critical, and it's missing. So our premise is, you know, our guiding principle is, if what we do will help the other person understand another, then we've arrived.
How much do you think your history of living and working at a large number of different places around the world has driven your desire to build this company?
I've never been asked that. I think my parents moved around the world. My brother and I went to boarding school, and we went to a different city every summer, every alternate summer. So there was always this fluidity to our lives. And I was born and raised in India. I went to the U.S. to go to school, and you know, spent time in Europe and now Asia, and back and forth. And I think the benefit that gives is obviously in what I consider a much richer life than if I had been in any one location. And I don't know if that compels me to build Quilt, but I think it's certainly a factor.
Yeah. And you've built a different team than people might expect from a traditional AI company. Well, I'm not sure there's such a thing as a traditional AI company, but you know, when you describe the makeup of your team, it seems like you've purposely not just hired a team of incredibly talented engineers, that there's it's a broader team with a wider set of skills. Is that right?
Yes. We've been fortunate in the talent we've hired. A lot of people have taken bets to work with us in a weird eclectic environment. We have obviously have some very talented engineers, men and women, some great data scientists, but what we're trying to build in some ways hasn't been built before. And I say that not facetiously. We've hired cultural researchers, anthropologists, good writers, great designers. And the intent behind the AI is, unlike, say, a Facebook, which had a MySpace before it, or a Google, which had an Alta Vista before it, we're trying to index humanity and trying to take a tweet and make it human and understand the person behind it. And nobody does that today. So when we looked around, as you know, Stuart, I'm not actually a true technologist. My code is really bad. But, so we wanted to use third-party tools where we could, and we do use several third-party tools. But the core IP is in understanding an image, for example, and understanding it contextually, not just by the funky tags it has on Instagram, but it was an image of a sunset, and that sunset evokes an emotion inside you that would be peace or serenity. And that's what you're trying to capture as a human. You feel peaceful, happy, sublime in a gorgeous sunset in the Bahamas or Hawaii or Goa. And that's how we tag all our data. We tag it with an anthropological and a cultural lens. So everything, and for that, you need to have both left brain and right brain people in your organization.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible work environment. I did notice that on your website, which I'd encourage everyone to check out at quilt.ai, you have some really interesting articles. I assume this is the part of the time that you said is used for your own curiosity and exploration.
Yes, so 25% of our time goes into you know, writing to think about and building on moonshot work. We also have a Medium page, if I can plug that here to check us out. But on a serious note, I mean, we debated whether we find sponsors or clients for certain things that we care about, or we just go ahead and build it first. So we decided to just build instead. And we've done some fascinating work around understanding suicides based on people's commentary and the color and the texture of the photos they take. We spent a lot of time understanding teenagers, their sex behavior patterns around, you know, the risky pregnancies, things like that. And we spent a lot of time looking at child nutrition and also you know, depressing spaces like child porn, which we now actually do some paid work for. But the intent is to use machines where we can to find patterns and insights, and if those insights can be used to stop a deplorable behavior, then that's great. Or to augment a good behavior, then that's fantastic. But yeah, that's what the stuff is on the website's about.
And who on your team is doing the fun projects, like the research on alcohol trends and travel habits and things like that?
Yeah, so we pushed something out on travel, I think, yesterday around how men and women travel differently. And it was really funny. It was looking at Instagram photos at scale of how men post and women post. And we are very different people in the way we portray ourselves and in the way we capture. So there is a team that builds content both for client reportage and then also for working on the fun stuff and the serious stuff.
And I assume that if there are any bar owners out there, that if they looked at your research, they would know they should start thinking of new cocktails that involve dark rum.
You know, it was our most popular piece, not just in terms of social media love, but almost everybody I ran into say, that, you know, I thought gin was it, but clearly not.
Yes, I thought it was fascinating and it's a really good advertisement for what your system is capable of.
Thank you.
Yeah. So if someone is interested in learning more about Quilt.ai or possibly working with you and your team there, what should they do? Where's the best place for them to go?
Gosh, you know, ping me. I promise a response within 24 hours. It's anurag@quilt.ai. We're hiring aggressively. I think we have about 26 open positions that we need to fill in the next 2 to 3 months. We have open positions in New York and London, and also several in Singapore. So we're looking for fun, interesting people. We have a set of values around us in terms of us being, we like to be hyper efficient, we like to be humble, and we're like to be happy, and fundamentally we like to be kind. So if that is you, then anurag@quilt.ai is a great way to hit me up.
That sounds great. What are your plans and ambitions for this company in the years ahead?
Stuart, I'm a middle-aged entrepreneur, right? So I hopefully am a little more pragmatic, and I don't think world domination is feasible. I think, you know, Angad and I plan on running this for the next 40 years. It is the last thing that I will do in my life professionally. We're not thinking exit, any of those pieces. I think there's a lot of work to be done. Our clients have been phenomenal. We're extremely revenue positive. So as a fiscally sensible, viable business, we definitely are there. And so the ambitions would be, you know, every organization that is taking a decision about how to talk to its consumers should use us. Every nonprofit that wants to understand its beneficiaries and their lives better should use us. And if they end up making better decisions because of the quality of their data and the interpretation that we do, then we'd be pretty excited.
Well, I just think it's a fascinating business, and I really appreciate you taking some time to tell us about it today.
Thanks for having me on, Stuart.
All right, I really enjoyed that conversation with Anurag, and now I'm going to be joined by Kim Von Arks of Caravelle Law. All right, delighted to now be joined on the podcast by Kim Von Arks from Caravelle Law. Kim, why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice?
Sure. My focused expertise are technology law, procurement, and BPO, and data privacy in particular, actually the Canadian data privacy and the GDPR in Europe, and then actually some of the European countries individually. Intellectual property, and then I have some general expertise with respect to governance and general corporate commercial and not-for-profits, actually.
That sounds perfect. So I just had the interview with Anurag from Quilt.ai, and he told us all about the data that they are collecting, which is a massive amount of data. What are some of the things that companies should do or keep in mind to give people comfort that the data that's being collected is being handled responsibly?
Well, I'm not actually going to go into any kind of procedural or regulatory discussion or description. I think it's more from a principal perspective that companies really need to be aware of. And important is that the company is transparent about their personal data use and very honest and open about it, that they're actually reasonable in what they actually are doing with it, and they don't abuse consumers' trust. And if they comply with those four and really stick to those, obviously within the overall regulatory framework under which they then have to operate, I think that will really lead to significantly increased consumer trust with respect to how their information is being processed and dealt with.
And do companies usually share that sort of policy on their website so that consumers know what's being done?
Well, it's through their overall privacy policy and, for that matter, cookies policy, which they quite often have on their website. And there are some companies which actually go beyond that and even have a general statement with respect to what their principles are with respect to how they treat personal data. And then the details are set out in the privacy policy. And I think a company really shows real concern and interest in the consumer's interest with respect to their personal data and protecting their personal data if they make the privacy policy as easy to understand and simple as possible.
Do you see a movement towards simpler privacy policies recently?
Yes, in Europe, it's actually a requirement under the law. It has to be fair, it has to be concise, it has to be legible, and it has to be actually geared towards your particular specific audience. So, for example, if there's somebody who wants to actually has some services for some minors, then it has to be written in such a way that actually that particular minor, obviously, if they're of reading age, can actually potentially understand what you've put into your particular policy. And that trend has actually become more, I suppose, what has become more embraced by various companies here in Europe. It certainly hasn't reached the level where you think, okay, man, this is like reading a comic book, but it has certainly gotten much better than the legalese that we lawyers sometimes like to throw at people just for the heck of it.
Now, you mentioned you have GDPR compliance expertise. How should Canadian companies be thinking about GDPR and whether it applies to them? What about for companies that are based in Canada?
Well, I mean, first off, you need to really understand your own business. And in particular, you have to understand how the data, the personal data or personal information, as it's called in North America, flows through your various systems and flows from entity to entity. So it could be, you know, very well that the data flows from the data subject to you, and then from you, it flows then eventually to some of your suppliers. For example, if you're a cloud service provider or your solution is somewhere in the cloud, then it will go to one of your cloud providers. And then within there, you might have some additional processes. So you really have to understand how your overall data map works. Then the other thing is you have to understand your own role, whether you are a controller or you are a processor of the data, or you're actually both in some instances. And I can tell you that, you know, any kind of commercial or non-commercial entity, for that matter, will always occupy at least a controller and a processor a role with some information or another. And the difference in particular is that with the controller, they actually determine the purpose of what the data is going to be used for, and the processor just processes the data based upon the controller's instructions. And then thirdly, understand and really limit the purpose of the use of the personal information. So you can't go just completely bananas and say, look here, I mean, I just want your consent to, I don't know, whatever you want to do with the data. You have to try to really limit it and be reasonable with respect to what you need to the data for. And you always have to actually keep the interest of the data subjects also in mind, and then just do a balancing test. And then on top of that, you have to make sure that your employees understand and actually comply with your framework that you will have hopefully put in place to deal with data protection. And then lastly, as I mentioned before, with respect to a purpose, you know, just don't be greedy, be realistic and fair in your use of personal data.
And if I'm out collecting information that's being shared publicly by people, do I still have obligations under GDPR as to how I handle that information? For example, things that people post on social media?
You do, actually. Under the GDPR, there are two categories. There's Article 13 and Article 14. And one of them is just, you know, you collect it yourself, the personal data, and then the other one, you actually obtain the personal information from, for example, some public sources. And matter of fact is, if you do, for example, let's just say you actually collect some information about individuals from, I don't know, LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever else, and you create a humongous database around it, you actually have an obligation to notify each individual from whom you have collected the data to let them know, by the way, we have collected your data from Facebook and LinkedIn, and we are going to use it for X, Y, and Z.
And given that those platforms are all global in nature, that's going to affect companies from all over the world who are collecting information from those sources, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, the thing is, you have to keep in mind that, you know, I mean, of course, I mean, if you, GDPR, for example, only applies if you actually are processing information of individuals which are in the European Union. And there are lots of people out there who are saying that you know, you have to, GDPR only applies if it is an EU citizen, but that's not the case. It's anybody who's actually within the confines of the EU. So for example, if you, Stuart, suddenly travel through one European airport, and during that time, you're suddenly accessing some site outside of the EU, you're going to be protected under the GDPR.
Well, that's really helpful information, Kim. I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely.
I want to thank my guests on the podcast today, Anurag Banerjee, the co-founder and CEO of Quilt.ai, and Kim Von Arx, a lawyer with Caravelle Law. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Business Decisions podcast. We'll be back next week with episode 8. If you'd like more information about Caravelle Law, please check us out at caravellelaw.com. Thank you for downloading this episode of the podcast. We hope you'll subscribe, leave us a rating, and share this podcast with others that you think would benefit from these conversations. Until then, we hope all of your business decisions are great ones.